You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome, Wiretappers. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. We're going back to Chicago again today. But first, don't forget to support your local podcast by making a little, buy me a cup of coffee, make a little donation on your Venmo app. It's just use the word Gangland Wire, all one word, and you can buy me a cup of coffee. Well, again today, we have our good friend and fellow mob historian, outfit historian, Cam Robinson, coming to you from Chicago via Skype. Now, I will do this on YouTube. I'll put it up on YouTube immediately, and later on, we'll edit this together with a little better sound quality than what will be on YouTube into a full podcast. And I'm going to have like a whole month or maybe 6 weeks of Chicago outfit stories. So, Cam, welcome. It's really been great working with you, and we're going to continue to work with you. I could use the help, so really glad to have you here today, Cam.
Real happy to be here, Gary. Thanks. Thanks for having me, as always. I really enjoy it.
You know, we started working on the Wild Bunch, and I had already done the 80s Wild Bunch. You and I have done the 70s Wild Bunch and talked about Butch Petroselli quite a little bit, one of the main characters in that. I did a podcast on Harry Alleman, who was another one of the main characters and Butch Petroselli's partner in the early days on the Wild Bunch, and with a lot of killings and extortions and all kinds of fun activities that the outfit will participate in. So today we're going to talk about Jerry Scarpelli. And Cam has done a whole lot of really great research on this guy. He's an interesting guy. He's like the rest of these guys. He's a bad character. Cam, I noticed that he starts out, he specialized in armored car heist and bank robbery. So he had to have made a lot of money over his lifetime, and the outfit would have taken their street tax piece of that.
I think, yeah, if given his druthers, Jerry Scarpelli would have stuck with robberies. He did a few armed car and bank robberies. He mostly armed car, but he didn't have a problem with dashing into the bank and getting the armed car guy in the bank. He did a few of those, well over $300,000 in the late 70s. He got a couple Brinks cars and Brinks couriers walking into the bank. He cleared over $1 million on those three heists between 1978 and 1979. I think he was like a lot of these guys. He was a little poor with money, so to hear him talk about it later in life, he was always kind of hard up. He was kind of a knock around guy. So while he did make quite a bit of money on his robberies, I think that he was not especially a well-to-do guy, because on the outfit side, he didn't make it too high in the ranks. And what money he did have, he sort of blew through and didn't, we'll say, invest too wisely.
Interesting. You know, I noticed that over my years in the intelligence unit here, and you'd watch these guys, and you knew they were making pretty good money. But, I mean, if they were, they might be 30, 35 years old, and if they weren't married, they'd still be living at home. They would always have an expensive car and a big wad full of cash in their pocket, but they never really had any kind of investments or real money, and as they got older, they seemed to have hardly any money and started kind of going down the tubes, a lot of them, even though they'd had some big scores. I guess there's no 401k in the mob, is there? And they're not particular big savers. They more live for the day.
That does seem to be the case. I know a lot of the guys in Chicago and some of the older guys elsewhere in New York and Cleveland, they did tend to build towards the future. You do see some of the upper echelon guys that are investing in legitimate businesses and putting a little bit aside that way, hiding in the background. But the rank and file, for the most part, they tend to be flashier and just going for the quick buck and not in it for the long haul, because they're always assuming around the corner is going to be the next big score.
Yeah, I think gambling gets a lot of them. I think they're such huge risk takers, and they love to gamble. All risk takers love to gamble. And I think, though, you know, there's no gambler that ever ends up with a lot of money except the bookie who, you know, bounces the books. He doesn't really gamble. He doesn't win or lose. He just takes the vig from the losers. And a lot of these guys will lose, you know, five and six figures on bets on different sporting events.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing about Scarpelli with his heists is the outfit did notice early on. He did draw a lot of attention. You start knocking over armored cars, and you're going to draw a lot of attention. That was basically how he got into murder for hire, more or less. He got into some hot water with the bosses. You're drawing a lot of attention with these armored cars. I mean, $300,000-$400,000 goes missing. They start looking. And when the outfit runs the area, they know who to ask. So he started hitting people. He started doing murders because that was sort of how he got himself out of hot water. Is he could commit a murder here or there, and well, as long as we can count on the guy to do the heavy work, we'll sort of let it sweep it under the rug that he's drawn a lot of attention to us with these murders. I mean, with these robberies.
Yeah, interesting, y'all. They do. They see an armored car heist go down in the newspaper in the Chicago Tribune, and then if they haven't already had some knowledge of it or are already getting a piece of that action, they're probably asking around, who did that? They want to know who did it. Once they find out who did it, if it's somebody like Scarpelli who's a connected guy, then you know he's going to have to give a piece of that action, I'd say at least 25%. You know, Frank Collada told us that Tony Spilotro would take as much as whatever. There's like five guys on a job, so they were going to split it up five ways. Spilotro, even though he wasn't on the job, even though he may not have even planned it, he would take his 1/6 share. Then he would be in for an equal share from everybody else. And I'm sure that's exactly what happened to Scalise or Scarpelli and his things. You know, I noticed you did dig up kind of interesting things that he made some attempts to go legitimate back in the day. He invested a lot of money in a jewelry store. What else did he do?
His sister-in-law, he had put in a little bit of money. He worked for a shipping company that his brother owned just to try and make ends meet. With all the money he was making, he was still trying to make ends meet, just working a union job. He really, really didn't ever make it too high up. He was well respected in the mob, but he was never running his own crew, and he was never running his own business. The jewelry shop didn't do especially well, and it eventually folded. He had a couple five figures invested with a bookie who wasn't especially successful. So he wasn't a guy who was like you said, who was doing too well. He had a nice car that he really cared a lot about. He was cared a lot about his appearance. He tried to look good, but he was a weightlifter. Aside from his appearance and a few flashy things, though, he wasn't a guy who was doing very well.
Yeah, interesting. I knew a guy exactly like that. He always had a brand new Lincoln, you know, huge big gold rings, big heavy gold chain. Nice clothes, always hung out in the joints, you know, flashed a lot of money. But when you looked into his real home's life and all that, and I saw him later, it was like, you know, living like you know, like a factory worker that was partially unemployed half the time, or an unemployed you know, vendor or something. Later in his life, I was at court. After I became a lawyer, I was at court, in an Associate Circuit Court. And I heard his name come up on the docket, but it wasn't him. It must have been his son, because he was in the crowd. But his son had some kind of a theft charge going on, and he was having to use a public defender. And so I think this guy, he never, ever saved any money at all. But he still looked like he had $1 million that day. He's just getting older.
Right.
So, you know, Scarpelli, another thing that you dug up, and I didn't really realize this before, it was he was part of what turned out to be a kind of a famous case called Gagnon versus Scarpelli, which made a fundamental change in the way the law treats people that are on probation and whose probations are violated. What do you remember about what led up to that?
Supreme Court case. He was, which really, really kind of blew me away. He was arrested in 72 in Wisconsin for armed robbery. He got, gave him 15 years, but the judge gave him 7 years probation. Of course, the very next year, he was arrested in Chicago for armed robbery again. And they immediately violated his probation and gave him, I believe they gave him 7 years right off the bat. And Then he appealed it shortly thereafter. He was 3 years into his term when he was released based on the Gagnon versus Scarpelli. But I think you could probably give us a bit more in-depth into the actual case with your background. But that was the lead up to it, and he said that his the terms of his probation and how they went about getting his confession things were completely unjust.
Yeah, really. I was as a lawyer, you know, I read a lot of cases like this. This is one of the things you had to do in criminal law, particularly, was read cases and then say, what's the point of this case? Go and get two or three sentences about what does this case mean. It'll be, you know, 20 pages of writing, but you got to figure out what it means in the end. And in this case, what it meant was that he claimed that his he was arrested for a burglary, and he claimed that they took a confession from him under duress, and that should not be used against him. But that would be adjudicated in the burglary case. Well, he's out on probation for robbery or probation. Yeah, he was out on this probation for these armed robberies, and they just slapped him back into the penitentiary because for a couple of reasons, but they didn't give him a hearing. They claimed it was just because he admitted to this burglary, and because when he was arrested, he was in the company of another convicted felon, which is a violation of probation, which is, you know, that's one that, you know, a lot of people will be out with their brother-in-law and they're in the company of another convicted felon. That's one you only use when you really need it. They don't always use that in the company of another convicted felon. So what came out of that case was that they didn't give him a hearing. And now, ever since then, I believe that was 1976 when the U.S. Supreme Court made its final ruling on this. And ever since then, if you get picked up for probation violation, you have two hearings. You have what they call Gagnon 1, or a hearing just to see if there was any probable cause, any real reason why you should be picked up and held for probation violation and kept in custody until the next hearing, and at which the next hearing would be like a full hearing with, the state would have to present some kind of evidence as to why they were violating his probation or his parole, either one. And before you can take anybody's freedom away, once you've got your freedom, you have to have due process or some kind of a hearing in front of a neutral or a judge. And both sides have to be able to present evidence, and both sides have to be able to question witnesses, and that the whole nine yards, just like a full trial. And so that was his contribution to criminal law, Mr. Gerald Scarpelli's.
So it sounds like just that based on his behavior and his associations, they just violated his probation without any hearing. Based on Scarpelli, they have to give him a hearing.
Yeah, they just read the police reports. And here's what they do. They just read the police reports. And I remember doing this with probation officers. They just read the police reports and say, oh, look, he's in the company of a convicted felon. Let's send him back.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Now you have to have a hearing in front of a judge and have that officer come in and testify as to how he knew this other person was a convicted felon and how he put them together. You know, were they just walking down the street about the same place at the same time and the officer thought they were together? So that's, that would be a way that you could say, well, I wasn't really with a convicted felon because he just happened to be in the same place at the same time that I was. And then the state would have to overcome that defense. So that's kind of how I think that's as understandable a way as I can put it on this hearing on the evidence. So he goes on, your research, and we're going to get a little bit in the Chop Shop Wars, which was a pretty well-known outfit dispute up in Chicago area. But we're going to have a whole program on the Chop Shop Wars. But he ends up working with the Wild Bunch, during this time in the middle to late 70s, and getting started killing people in the Chop Shop Wars. How did that, who was he working with, and what were some of their crimes?
When he was with the Wild Bunch, they were, in addition to getting the street tax in Chicago, they did a lot of subcontracting, we'll say, for people, other crews outside of their area. And they did some work for Chicago Heights, which was a pretty large area. They were doing some mixing up with the Chop Shop Wars that was going on, and when the two factions split, as we'll get into, they did some work for another mob guy, Al Toko, who was a major lieutenant in Chicago Heights, and they started killing some guys who owned some junkyards there. And Scarpelli had no compunction about killing anybody, and he would later go on to say, "Well, it's just business, it's just what you do." And he had never any remorse, never anything, and he was certainly didn't hesitate to execute anybody. So he would, when you needed somebody down right away, and you have a lot of these murders where you have two or three guys show up with ski masks on, and they blast somebody, and they jump into a fast car, and they take off and go. You know, the ones that you could track down. I mean, they're just during the 70s, during 77 especially, which was a bumper year for the Chicago outfit, just so many murders in 77. But throughout the 70s, these cases of guys pulling up with ski masks, blowing someone away in the middle of the street and driving away, just myriad cases of that. So that was the Wild Bunch's specialty, is pull up, shoot somebody in the middle of the street, wherever, didn't matter, and jump in a fast car and get away.
So Cam, some of these first murders, like there's a junkyard owner, I see Richie Farrow and his partner Frank Theo. Now, Al Toko, what was he trying to extract a street tax from these guys who were buying stolen cars or cutting up stolen cars and then putting them back into the stream of commerce? Is that what the deal was? And then he hired the Wild Bunch like Scarpelli and Scalise to...
In Indiana at the time, there was no laws about title insurance. So if you wrecked a car, the title didn't have to indicate that it was wrecked. So if you wanted to buy a wrecked car and it was a black Camaro and it was totaled, okay, so you bought the car and you got the title. And then if you see a black Camaro driving down the road and you send somebody to steal it and pull it up and you pop the VIN and swap it out, and you can get the parts from the totaled car, and then you sell a brand new car with a title, and it shows brand new Camaro, and you know you got it for free, and you sell it. You paid, you know, $1,000 for the wrecked one, and you sell it for you know $6,000-$7,000, and you turn around the profit. That was huge business in Indiana. So a lot of these junkyard guys, they were all doing it. They didn't want to kick up to the mob. So you'd send these guys like Jerry Scarpelli and his partner Scalise or the Wild Bunch, and either you start kicking into the mob or you don't. And if you don't, you know, you're going to end up in either that junkyard, that graveyard up in DuPage County, or maybe you won't be found. And this guy, Richie Ferrero, he was never found. Scarpelli's partner, Jerry Scalise, who was another killer, he worked for Ferrero. And he worked with Frank Theo. Those guys both disappeared. I believe they found Theo's body, but Ferrero never turned up. And his junkyard turned over to somebody else. This other guy, Mark Thanosaras, he was a ex-Chicago PD district captain. He did 18 months. He was going around shaking down businesses, and he was asking protection money for as a district chief of the Chicago Police Department. He was mobbed up, and as soon as he gave some testimony against the outfit, as soon as he got out of jail, two masked guys pulled up and blew him away in the middle of the street. And he just Chicago police just got out of prison, and they blew him away as soon as he hit the street. That was the kind of job that you would get Scarpelli to do, and they knew he was dependable. They sent him out to do it.
I remember reading about that one. I think that guy was walking out of a strip club or something, or getting ready. Just got out of his car, was going into the strip club. That kind of caught my attention. Chicago police captain serves time in the penitentiary, and then was a victim of a hit right after he comes out. Like only in Chicago will that happen.
That was a big one.
Chicago, God, that's amazing.
That was a real big
one. You found several close ties with Butch Petroselli, and they ended up having a falling out. Tell us a little bit about that. That was really interesting.
He and Butch that we talked about last time, they were pretty close. They both had the same background, which was growing up on that Taylor Street, that Little Italy. And you see that throughout the mob, whether it's Federal Hill in Providence or Murray Hill in Cleveland or Bensonhurst in Brooklyn, these small enclaves in these little Italies where these guys grow up, they're all together, and they graduate either to the police force or to the mob, but they're really tight guys, and they were both born around 1938, and they came up and they got started together. They did robberies together, and throughout they were both in the Wild Bunch together, and they did a lot of jobs. They both did robberies and different things, but Scarpelli, he did a couple of those armed car robberies we were talking about in the late 70s, and this is at a time when he was working for the Taylor Street crew, the Cicero crew, and Butch had gotten a little promotion after he had done so well with the Wild Bunch, and a couple of the other partners went to prison. Alan Ailman and another guy, Jimmy Inandino, they both had gone to prison, and Butch got his promotion, and Scarpelli did these armed car robberies, and they'd sort of been sanctioned. They said, well, you've done some murders for us, so, you know, it's okay. You didn't have to pay any more. So he paid his cut, and he was okay. Then Petroselli comes to him and says, no, we're going to need a little bit more money. These robberies were bigger than we thought. So Joe Ferriola, who was the boss of Cicero at the time, said he needs a little bit larger cut. Scarpelli's furious. He gives Butch the cut because he doesn't want to make ripples, but he shows up at Ferriola's house at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, you know, what the hell's going on? I thought I was in the clear. I gave you your money. Why is Butch telling me that you want more money? Ferriola, this is 3 o'clock in the morning. He comes out in his driveway. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't tell Butch I wanted more money. He said, well, Butch is going around using your name saying that you're demanding more money from people. He said, well, Butch is using my name, demanding money that he's not given to me. So, as we talked about, Butch was getting a little big for his britches, and he was throwing parties and dropping names and skimming. Now we have evidence that Butch is skimming, and what he did with Scarpelli, using the boss's name without the boss's permission, was a big no-no. And that was the final nail in his coffin, and Scarpelli was the one who sort of drove it. That was when they called Butch in for a meeting with the bosses, and that was when he was jumped on the street. They, choked him out and slit his throat, and Scarpelli was the one who took his body and drove it away, and then they sent another crew to burn it, and that was when they screwed it up, and that was the picture that I sent you. But it was Scarpelli who reported him for skimming because he demanded that money from the armored car jobs. He demanded it in the name of the boss. The boss had already gotten his cut and had not asked for more.
Yeah, bad news. You don't go out and steal from the bosses. Because that's basically what he was doing.
Exactly.
When he uses the boss's name to extort money, he was stealing from the boss because the boss should have got that, at least a piece of it.
Exactly.
Well, he ends up working with this Duke, and I can't think of his real first name, Duke Basile, which is going to kind of be his undoing, one of the more important FBI informants up there.
Yeah, another guy had, Peter Pankowitz or something, had informed and caught Duke, and then Duke became an informant, Duke Basile. Duke Basile was informing for about 2 years. They were riding around doing robberies, he and Scarpelli. What they would do is they would go to, Scarpelli would pick up the weapons, Duke wasn't a killer, and they would pick up machine guns and firearms. They would store them in a garage. The FBI would be trailing them the whole time. Duke was wired for sound. The FBI was listening to everything they said, and Scarpelli was a talker. The FBI would watch them drop off the weapons at this safe garage where they had cars parked and everything, work cars. The FBI would then go and pick the lock. They would disarm the weapons so that they wouldn't fire. They'd take out the pins and everything. The FBI would set up the jobs. They would give Duke the information. Here, go to this house, and we'll set up. We'll plant something in a safe, and we'll have cameras set up around the house. And so they would set up the jobs. Jerry and Duke would go. They'd break into the house. The FBI would be parked outside, filming the whole job, wired up for sound, listening to everything the whole time. Duke is wearing wires. They just totally. They got Jerry dead to rights. They got Scarpelli nailed. For about 2 years worth of doing this, setting up jobs, disarming weapons, just got him set up. Because they know Scarpelli is juiced in, and based on his conversations with Duke, they're hearing everything he's got to say. And he's talking about bosses, he's talking about crews, he's talking about murders. So they know they've got somebody. And they pull up to him after this one of the robberies, and they call him over to the car, and they get him in. He's with his girlfriend. They say, you know, we'd like to talk to you about something real quick. And they lay out their case, and they lay out their evidence, and Scarpelli looks at him, and he says, well, it sounds like you guys got me pretty good. And they go downtown, and he talks to him for a while. He doesn't want to talk to him at first, but after a while he relents. And Scarpelli talks to the FBI for quite a while. He for a couple days he feeds them information. They get a good report of about a couple hundred pages worth of information on murders he's committed. He tells them some stuff. He doesn't admit to other things. He tells them, well, when it comes to murder, you don't get paid extra. It's just something you got to do. It's just a part of the job. He tells them different politics within the crews and how there's poor communication between different crews in Chicago and how they relate to one another and who's different bosses. So the FBI gets a lot of information about him. He offers to go to wear a wire, but because he's killed a lot of people, they don't want to let him out. So at the last minute, Scarpelli decides he doesn't want to testify. He doesn't want to work with the FBI. He recants all this information he's given him. He tries to do it on the same grounds that he used earlier in the Supreme Court case. He says they compelled this information out of him on false grounds. They wouldn't let him use the bathroom. They wouldn't let him sleep. They promised him all kinds of things that they didn't deliver. And they really leaned on him pretty heavily, and it went to court, and the judge found that his objections to his earlier testimony were without merit. So he went to jail, and the FBI was able to keep their information. The FBI got a lot of information about Scarpelli about the outfit.
Yeah, plus, I mean, that was more important than he was going to go to jail anyhow. They already had this Basile. They already had him, and through him they had Scarpelli. So I guess he was just trying to save face in front of his outfit bosses. I would imagine that he had did that much talking. Now, I wonder whatever happened to that report. There must be like a one big long 302, as the FBI calls it, that has a lot of information in it that would be interesting reading.
I think you could probably get, you could probably get a FOIA now that he's, you know, after.
He's dead, yeah.
He's dead now. You could get the FOIA now that he's dead.
I may have to take a look at that. They redact the heck out. They redact. I've done some of those FOIAs, and they redact so many names that sometimes, I mean, names, I don't even understand why they redact them. They even redact the names of policemen who are part of the, I mean, they're not suspects. They're like, Sergeant redacted so-and-so called and said this, you know, or, you know, like if I'd working with the FBI, they would redacted my name when I called them, giving them information about something I was working on, a case that I knew they were interested in. But anyhow, be that as may, one thing I noticed that as I was doing my own research, that part of this, just the, what we call gravy in the wiretap and the technical surveillance world, or the T3 world, as they call it, Title III world, there's a thing called gravy when you're listening to something about a specific case, and that's what your wiretap's for, but you hear something about another case and some other situation that you really want to find out about, and it's a pretty good clue into that. You can use that, as gravy, what they call gravy, and as probable cause maybe for something else. So they picked up a pretty important piece of gravy out of this, although I don't know if any cases were made out of it. But they heard him talking about and make some indication about some mob or outfit graveyard up there in north of Chicago somewhere. I believe it was in DuPage County, and that on the north side there.
Yes, yeah.
What do you remember about that whole mob graveyard thing?
Oh yeah, that was they found a couple bodies up there. They found one guy, Michael Oliver, that Scarpelli had something to do with, and they found another guy, Harder or something, that Scalise had something. Your guy Scalise that you did had something to do with, I believe, a guy out of Ohio. They found a couple bodies buried down there. And that was in the late 80s, really shortly after Scarpelli. And then 10 years later, about 50 yards from that graveyard, they found another guy, Chris Cruz, who was a cousin of Harry Alleman. They found him, and I read another report that said that this guy Chris Cruz owned the land that another guy, this Richie Farrow, who was a victim of Scarpelli, he owned the land where this guy was killed. So, you know, like we've talked about before, the relationships between these guys and who's killed on what's land and who ends up dead and who's whose cousin who gets killed anyway. You know, they're pretty intricate. But that mob graveyard, they said they barely scratched the surface on who might be up there. But they dug. It was a pretty extensive dig. They brought dogs up there. There was some development that was going in, a medical center, I think, wasn't it, you found? But they dug up there quite a bit, pretty extensively, trying to find things up there, sifting the ground and cadaver dogs and everything up there.
Yeah, from what I understand, there was like a drug and alcohol treatment center up there that some of it was already in, so they didn't really get to dig underneath everything. There's no telling how many bodies might still be up there. And that whole thing with Harry Alleman's cousin, that was so interesting. I read about that. I didn't realize that he owned some of that land, which kind of harkens back to a Sopranos episode. I don't know if you ever watched the Sopranos, but you know, everything they've got in there, they've read in some kind of a police report or a case file of some kind. So they had buried a body in upstate New York at some farm that one of their old guys owned, and somebody was getting rid of the farm, and so they had to go up and dig the body up and go bury it someplace else. I think they had another episode where they were all nervous because they had buried a body in the basement of a house, and I think somebody had bought the house and they're remodeling it, or they're demolishing the house for some new project in the neighborhood, and they were all sweating out if the body was ever going to be found.
That was a Goodfellas too. They said Henry Hill said they had to move that Billy Bats body. Developed that land. They had to go back up there and move that body. And they talk about that in Wise Guys by Nicholas Pileggi. They had to move the body 6 months later. They were going to do development up where they had put the body.
Yeah. So hazards of the trade when you're in the mob and you're burying bodies. You know, you talk about somebody, he knows where all the bodies are buried. Well, he may not now because they may have had to change some of them. I think the ideal thing is to, well, another Sopranos where they took the guy way out to the ocean, killed him on the boat, and then threw him over in the ocean.
Yeah, don't have to worry about it then.
Right. Run him through a wood chipper or find some way to totally dispose of those bodies, man. That's we've had two or three here in Kansas City. They've never found the bodies. I always wondered about that. They have never, ever found the bodies. In one case, this guy, he ran he was kind of a part-time guy that really nobody liked. He ran a bingo that was, when we first started bingo in Missouri, this is before gambling, and it starts off with bingo, why they would create a nonprofit, because you have to have a nonprofit that's going to get the money and run the bingo. They're supposed to use their volunteers to run bingo, and they take the profit off the bingo. So the mob creates a kind of a phony nonprofit. They get a couple of corrupt preachers to sit on the board and act like it's going to go to their church. And, and then they run the bingo, and then all their people go in and run the bingo game. And this guy, Sal Manzo, his name, he ran that bingo game and made money, made some money for the mob, but he did something. We never really figured out exactly what it was. But all of a sudden, he's disappeared. We can't find Sal Manzo. His girlfriend was not even looking for him, so she knew. And about a week later, about two weeks later, we had a detective who lived over in, you talk about those Taylor Street area and Bensonhurst, well, we have Columbus Park. Well, this detective was Italian heritage, and he lived over in that area, and he was not corrupt or crooked or anything. He was just, you know, he just happened to be Italian and come from the neighborhood. And somebody, he got an anonymous phone call and said to go up to St. John and Belmont and look in the trash can. So he calls the dispatcher and has a couple of cars meet him up there. There's old Sal Manzo's clothes. So what they wanted to do, they did not want the body found, but they wanted the family to know that he was dead.
Uh-huh.
I tell you, these guys, they're so family-oriented, too. I mean, that was
7 years before the body can be, somebody can be declared dead.
Yeah, exactly. Matter of fact, I still have, I was doing a program one time, and that same guy, a guy stood up to answer questions after showing my movie, and this guy stood up, and he said, well, I want to talk to you afterwards about Sal Manzo. Are you familiar with that murder? And I said, yeah, I am, and the one I just described. And I met up with him afterwards, and this Sal Manzo had some relatives, and actually one of them, she was a cousin, or a niece, I think she was a niece, who was now a judge up in Minneapolis, I believe, or Milwaukee, somewhere up north like that. And he said that the family, you know, was still wondering about his body and whatever happened to him. If I had any idea what happened to him, would I talk to them? But I said, you know, dude, I got no idea. So interesting. Well, I tell you what, Scarpelli, whatever happened to him then?
Like you said about family, Scarpelli, when he realized the FBI was not going to that his testimony was going to stand, and the bosses were soon going to know that he had spoken, he was in the Metropolitan Correction Center, and he was in the bathroom there, and he hanged himself in the bathroom, and that was it for him. There are some people who said, well, what's his name, Frank Schweitz was in the prison at the same time, but Scarpelli was a big guy. He was lifted weights every day, was a health nut, and Schweitz was older at the time. I think that Scarpelli could have handled himself. He hanged himself. He was a family guy. He was a proud guy. He didn't want his family to have any trouble. He didn't want them to have to deal with the mess of an informant and witness protection and all that mess, or any kind of fallout from the outfit. And he didn't want to deal I think he didn't want to deal with the mess of that he had gotten himself into. He'd spent his life in on one side of things, and he had flipped at the end, and I think he really regretted speaking to the FBI. I think he had done it in a moment of weakness for somebody like that, and he ended it. He hanged himself, and that was the end for Jerry Scarpelli. I think he was 51 years old.
Well, he was just another one of those outfit terrorists and
live by
career
the sword.
Criminals.
Live by the sword, die by it.
Yeah, exactly. Go back. I kind of like to at least we've mentioned a couple of their victims. You've got a nice little list of probably his victims. Let's go over those just a little bit before we finish this off, Cam.
I think one that really, really gives you a good picture of how the outfit works is Tony Borsellino, who he worked with in the Wild Bunch. Tony Borsellino was a killer, was a tough guy. Butch Petroselli was the one who said that Tony Borsellino was skimming from the outfit. It was probably true. Butch was a liar, but Tony was an outfit guy, and they steal. Tony Borsellino he went to Frank Calabrese, another hitman, and asked for help. But Tony Borsellino would have trusted this Scarpelli. They worked together. They had just a few months earlier had killed this guy, Cristofalos, a club owner. They had just done a hit together. And I think that Borsellino would have trusted him. They went out, and Scarpelli shot him and left him down in, I believe it was Crete, which is a rural community just south of Chicago. Killed him and left him there. Together they had killed a lot of those people that robbed Accardo when there was that big robbery of Tony Accardo's place, the head of the Chicago outfit, when those guys broke in. But the fact that you could look at somebody who you trusted, you had just been working with for 8 or 9 years, even as a hitman, but you had been working together, and then soon as the 2 weeks earlier, you had just killed somebody together. I guess that builds a bond. I don't know, but then you just the bosses snap their fingers and then you shoot that guy and that really gives a good illustration of how these guys operate.
Yeah, really. What about this Richard Crofton? He's what we affectionately refer to in Kansas City as a peckerwood. He is a non-Italian. So what was the deal with him?
It was, you know, I tried to track that down. There was a whole situation going on there with this catering thing, and it looked like there must have been some kind of mobbed up caterer. These two catering companies, Teresa Schaefer and her husband John Schaefer, they owned two companies. John Schaefer owned some restaurant, and he was a bookkeeper. Teresa Schaefer owned Southside Catering, and they were tied in with this other guy, John Lorgos, who owned a restaurant. Lorgos was executed. I meant to put him on this list. He was executed right in front of his house. Teresa Schaefer received a bunch of death threats. Her car got bombed, but it was also a car her husband drove. Her husband looks like he died, but he had received death threats too. This woman who worked in his restaurant, Rita Payunk, she was killed. They were good friends with that Mark Thanosaurus. They were partners with him, and he obviously was killed. They were also partners with this club owner, this George Christofalos, who was the club owner that I said earlier was killed by Borsellino. And so there was something going on with these guys who owned this catering business, and I don't know if there was some kind of rival caterer that was mobbed up, but when you start seeing all these people who are related in some capacity, Richard Crofton was the manager for the Southside Catering, and he was shot right outside of his home. So here you've got the owner whose car is bombed, and she's receiving death threats. Her husband owns a place, and his bookkeeper is shot in the head, a woman. His partner is killed on the street. His other partner is killed on the street. The manager of his place is killed on the street. Another partner of his is killed. I mean, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. So I couldn't track down the exact story at the time, but I was really looking into it, trying to see what was happening. But there was something going on between 76 and 77 with these Southside caterers, and it looks like there was maybe somebody had connections and was trying to shut down the competition, because they did talk about there was a lot of competition between the Southside Catering, in particular with another catering company, and they had been having some problems. But it got pretty heated pretty quickly, and there were three men in masks. One of them was driving pretty quickly. They pulled up, shot them, and jumped into a Camaro, and the guy peeled off. And Scarpelli was known for his ability to drive, and he took pride in his ability to be a getaway man when he wasn't working the trigger.
Well, he's Sam Giancana. That's how he got his start as a getaway driver and a wheel man. Interesting.
Exactly.
So let's talk about one last one, and then we're going to wind this down. I'm kind of curious about this guy, Gerald Caracciolo, had been a driver for Joey Iuppa at one time. And what was the deal with that?
Caracciolo worked with Borsellino. They killed they teamed up to kill a couple of those guys from the robbery. I think you've talked about it before. I don't know. There was a big robbery that took place when a bunch of guys broke into Joey Accardo's, Tony Accardo. He was the boss of all of Chicago. And
it was a friend of Tony Accardo's, and he was making him give that jewelry back.
Correct. There was correct. So these jewel thieves broke into Tony Accardo, the boss of the outfit. And he comes home and he says, "I want them all gone." So systematically, all of these guys were executed with extreme prejudice. Their throats were slit. They were left in very public places. And Borsellino and Caracciolo were, they worked together on a couple of those murders. And we know Borsellino was accused of skimming. He was kind of high up. Carusiello was a driver. They had both been drivers for Iuppa, who was also one of the bosses of the mob. But as far as Carusiello, it looks like he was, oftentimes the outfit will kill guys who are a link to other murders. You see that a couple of times. You'll see a murder, and then immediately after, the guys who are suspected of committing the murder are also found dead. So if you draw too much attention to yourself as being a killer, so it looks like a couple of those hits were immediately tracked back to Carusiello. I think there was some evidence where it was indicated Carusiello was had at least been on the scene, and he was about to be questioned, and all of a sudden Carusiello turns up dead. Borsellino and Carusiello both had worked together and killed somebody. I can't remember who, but they had just killed one of the last of those burglars, and then they immediately end up dead together. And Scarpelli was the one who was credited with their demise. And when he spoke with the FBI, he claimed credit for killing both of them.
Well, so the buck stops here. This is where the link is broken. Never going to come back to me. That's a smart way to do it. Well, Cam, I really appreciate it. All your hard work, and this is great information. I think people will appreciate this, and the pretty great stories out of Chicago, out of the Chicago outfit. I want to finish this off with my public service announcement. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And as always, I thank you for listening to my podcast and listening to myself and Cam tell these Chicago outfit stories. If you have iTunes, why, you might think about giving me a review. And if you think about subscribing, when you subscribe, don't worry about hitting the subscribe button. All that means is you're going to automatically get updated when the latest episode is released. They don't ask you for a credit card or an email or anything. It just connects you to that podcast. You can unsubscribe at any time. If you've enjoyed what you hear and what we're doing and like to support this podcast, as I said before, go to the Venmo app and hit me up at Gangland Wire. Go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com, and hit the donate button. $25 or more, you'll get a free copy of my documentary, Gangland Wire, and then I have a companion book that goes with that, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. Both these works document the Kansas City mob and Chicago outfit and Milwaukee crime family and Cleveland, too, skimming money from Las Vegas casinos. I have over 200 free back episodes of Gangland Wire. And finally, don't forget about the Kansas City Mob Tour app in the Apple App Store. Good night, all you wiretappers out there. Good night, Cam. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.